They were researches, studies, and supervises excavations of ancient and medieval Indian sites of importance. His PhD was a study of the sculptures of grappling and pugilism of the Vijayanagara monuments. Apart from archaeology, he is a wrestling enthusiast, which he thinks has built more mental than physical strengths in him. How did a student who couldn't focus on his school studies develop this set of diverse career interests? That's what this fascinating conversation is about. This is episode 19 of My First Job, the podcast that covers engaging career journeys, and every single one is full of twists, turns, and insights. I am Venugopal Nair, the host of the podcast and CEO of Ideascape Communications, an advertising agency into branding, creative, and design. So settle in, sit back, and enjoy the conversation, or put on your earphones and pound the pavement or the parks. Kush, welcome to the show.
First of all, thank you very much for the great introduction. I don't think anyone in my family would give me such accolades the way you have given. Whatever career I've had, it's a very short career compared to a lot of people who have come on this show. I'm grateful for whatever good, bad, and ugly has happened. I studied at Sardar Patel Vidyalaya in Delhi, where the school was very compassionate towards my special learning disabilities that I had. I was actually diagnosed with dyslexia, but it is right now at the age of 31, 2 years ago, that I was properly diagnosed as a neurodivergent ADHD. For the longest time, my diagnosis like had been on a completely different tangent. I mean, it's okay. As long as my school was very good and compassionate with me, they never put any pressure on me. My parents never put any pressure. The only pressure was ki beta pass ho jana. I am actually very, very, very lucky there. Maths was a pressure, but I think my father learned to be okay with me not doing maths. I had some of the best teachers who sort of were just there for me, and I happened to like them and not the subject exactly. Predominantly, they were political science, history, sociology, economics teachers. Unfortunately, math teachers were a lot stricter. And out of that, the history teacher was the most dedicated towards me, honed my skills. Actually, she passed away when I was doing my undergrad at Hindu College in history honors in my first year. And I dedicated my PhD thesis to her. That's history. But it's still not archaeology, and I learned the difference between history and archaeology earlier than what a lot of archaeologists do. After doing history at Delhi University in Hindu College, for a lot of reasons, I realized that I wanted to study things that are more tangible, and my mental state, like my hyperactive brain, was never the type to, you know, stay in a room or a library or a classroom per se and just read. So I preferred being outdoors, seeing things for myself. And that's where archaeology struck a chord.
The love for history came from the teacher's attention. And she has obviously given you something that you will treasure your entire life, because she's pointed you in a direction that you know you can keep exploring. And what I was fascinated by during one of our early conversations is that you told me that you understood that you couldn't focus on a long term. So you looked at how to build your career around projects. How did that understanding come about?
That's still a work in progress. Yes. The understanding came out during the pandemic in 2020. It's like universe telling me now actually be serious and think about something. My career started after my undergraduation. I had the opportunity to teach 29 amazing kids in Seelampur in Delhi. I was a Teach for India fellow. Teach for India actually gave me a lot of insight into myself. Things that I realized that I am really good at was like being with kids, explaining certain concepts, just being out there in the field. I thrived when I was not in a very structural corporate setup in Teach for India. My manager, she was a British, and she was amazing the way she managed me. For her, she understood me that let's not make Kush do things which he doesn't like, but make him do things that he likes at the same time are aligned with Teach for India's vision. Okay. So I'm actually very lucky that I've had a lot of managers and bosses who were women. like Emma, and of course my mother. I think my first manager, the first Puraskar should go to my mother for, you know, being out there. Yeah. If you would ask her, I would actually tell her to give me a t-shirt and saying Karya Pragati Par Hai, right? Guy is always getting into something or the other. I think Emma, and then later on, I had a lot of female bosses. And I think I was very fortunate that my first set of classroom was 85% girl students. I think around them, kids used to make me calm, give me that motivation to go that extra mile. But say if my bosses told me to do that, I would not do it. But if I could feel it, okay, now I need to do it for my kids, I would definitely do it. So, you know, Teach for India is a compulsory two-year project. It's a fellowship. Mm-hmm. So I knew that in 2013, I'm going to get done with it. Then I did my master's. I was really sure. So I will be very honest and brutal about one thing, that I got into Teach for India because initially a lot of people who were getting into Teach for India were like the cream of the cream of Indian society and really brilliant people. Being surrounded by such brilliant minds in Teach for India, it actually gave me my own identity. And even today, most of my mentors are... So I was one of the youngest fellows in Teach for India because at that time, the students, they were still more focused on, oh, I need a career. I need to go to, say, McKinsey or a Bain or a BCG or study for the civil service. Like, the aspirations were still very stereotypical. And to be honest, Teach for India had not learned marketing very well at that point of time. Mm-hmm. So I think now they are excellent at it. Their outreach and everything is really good. But during that time, at least I could see that people who are coming, they did not have that ulterior motive of getting into, say, any good college. And even today, TFI actually gave me that push, figure it out, be opinionated. I used to be very vocal with everyone in TFI and I wasn't fired. That was the first phase. However, the type of experiences I had with Teach for India, I did not find a couple of my future organizations that I worked for later on to be as accommodating to me. I would say you can't clap with one hand. I was at mistake also. And I don't blame them to a certain extent because at the end of the day, everyone has to get their work done. That's when I realized that I should be choosing the people I want to work with rather than the names of the organizations and, you know, the setups I want to work. Couple of bad experiences at workplaces actually taught me not to go after brands. I ended up doing masters in archaeology. So like everyone from who does Teach for India, you know, they usually end up doing public policy. During my time, there were people doing MBA and, you know, or people just starting their own not-for-profits or for-profits. But I took a completely different tangent and I was always different. So like, it's not that something that anyone was surprised about. After working in 2-3 organizations where I was just not a fit for them and they were not a fit for me, I started taking up a lot of conscious decisions on, say, calibrating my expectations, always surrounded by people who were earning big packages and I wasn't. I took that route and tried to get into various setups where I worked 13, 14, 15, 18 hours a day. So I realized at the age of 26 that I'm not meant for this. My mother realized it when I was 28 and my brother realized it now. So like, you know, I mean, it's like more like a strength and conditioning happening for the entire family. And now I'm at a space where no one in my family questions. As long as you're doing what you want, and you are on your own, we are happy.
What is it that the children were looking for? Because you were going from being a student to becoming a teacher.
If I had not done Teach for India, I would have definitely pursued my master's in archaeology. I just thought, let's do this two-year fellowship and see how it goes. The fellowship never gave me that mindset that I don't want to get into archaeology. The universe has its way of working things out. Job prospects, career prospects, or anything monetary is not as rewarding in archaeology. Government being the sole major player in the archaeology and the heritage sector makes it even hard. I don't blame the government because our heritage is owned by the people of the country, select the government, hence the government owns it. Like any other government sector undertaking, you give a certain exam. So people who are in the system as in ASI or state departments, I actually don't see them doing a lot of archaeology. I actually see them doing a lot of desk work. So The pay scales are not even close to what anyone would imagine. The fellowship stipend in Teach for India was like a full-time salary for most of the people in archaeology at that. The balance was that bad. I loved archaeology so much that I decided a lot of credit goes to my mother and my brother. They said that if you have the capability to earn more by taking your education background and making more money, why don't you do that and do archaeology for fun and passion? I always wanted to make archaeology a career, living out of it. But to be honest, it was not until now. The first time I was employed as an archaeologist properly was in 21 in the Department of Science and Technology project on the DNA project of Rakhigarhi at Deccan College. Before that, I was so scared looking at my friends around. They are giving this government exam, they are giving that government exam. At least I can continue that much if, you know, I work in the development sector or if I say teach in an IB school or something. So I was just very practical, although I was miserable. Every day I wanted to quit. But I think those 8 years after my master's put a stone on my heart and just did what I did. If I did not have curriculum vitae the way it is now, I don't think you or anyone would approach me.
The initial years, when you put in the effort, when you're building your base, your foundations, nothing is seen above. It's as if you don't exist. But the point is, you're learning the most, you're absorbing the most, and you're internalizing so much that once you start taking off, then it's as if people are saying, okay, where did this guy come from? That is one of the mistakes that I see about people who aspire to. I'm not saying it's a mistake. Probably it's because of conditioning that they look at saying, I need a very high salary. And after that, the lifestyle fits the salary. And then it becomes a kind of wheel from which you can't break away. If you don't like it, you started by saying you love archaeology, so you're prepared to do whatever is required. It took you 7-8 years to get to where you are. But I think that this will really stand you in good stead. What part of archaeology, do you like the actual on-site?
There are a lot of learnings from archaeology I can't speak. Another thing is that I'm colorblind, but I didn't know how much it will affect me in archaeology. This is the first time that I am excavating in Rakhigarhi. I am going with my batch, my classmates from Bandra to Delhi, Dehradun Express. And my first experience is 2 o'clock at night, the train burns. We are stranded in Dhanu. People die. 2 compartments completely burn. That's the first time I'm like, maybe should I do archaeology or not? Now, fast forward a few days, we reach Rakhigarhi. Terrible cold, no water, no electricity. You know, like, I can't even see my food. And I'm so hungry that I don't want to see my food. Let's just eat it and go to sleep. Then, you know, when I started excavating, I'm a juvenile asthmatic and I'm a colorblind. You can say it was my immaturity that I still wanted to do archaeology. These two things were big limitations for me. On site, I fell sick. When I was sick, I went to Jind, which was the closest city because there were no antibiotics available for like 50 kilometers from the excavation site. So I come back. When we are excavating in India, no, everywhere in the world you have to observe is that we get a lot of pottery, and Rakhigarhi is a Harappan site. And in India, all the cultures, all the periods mostly are identified through the type of pottery we get. And the pottery is mostly identified based on shapes and color. Now the color part is gone for me. I mean, it was so funny that I would go to my professor, Professor Shinde, the site supervisor, Nilesh Bhau, and Amrita ma'am, who was the other professor. I actually took a lot of modern pottery to them. Ma'am, see Harappan pottery. And there was a time when all the people were like, tu mitti nikal. Color ka kaam humke chhod de. So like, I was literally like, using my forearms and, you know, taking out all the dirt and sand. And the other thing is that in archaeology, we need to see stratigraphy. When we excavate a trench, we have to basically mark and do some stratigraphy drawing. That is all either based on color and texture that you have to touch. Wherever I could make out that the texture is different, I was lucky. But a lot of time, I just missed all cultural layers. I think asthma and my colorblindness, studying art history with colored art is gone. Doing ceramic studies is gone. I actually did not like excavations much. One, because I always kept on falling ill. And the other is, people think that we archaeologists do a lot of amazing stuff. We have to stand at a trench and just wait for it to go down. If workers are there, we have to manage workers. And trust me, it's not a very good thing. It's very boring. I was at a site at Telangana called Fanigiri recently in 2018, and no antiquities are coming out from my trench. But I can't go anywhere. I'm supervising my trench. So there is no cool stuff happening. It's scorching sun. I don't speak Telugu. All I could speak is muttam excavate all. Mitti mitti ti ye. So like the workers taught me certain words. The reality of archaeology is that this is what majority of archaeologists face. I mean, I get a lot of messages on LinkedIn, like everything that, oh, I want to find a civilization. I want to find this, that. Earlier, I used to be very supportive to these youngsters. And now I'm like, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but that doesn't happen with everyone. They might hate me for the brutal honesty that I put in, but I think they will thank me for being honest to them, because when they actually get in, they're not finding anything. That's when you said grappling, right? I was a very active person because I was hyper. I got into martial arts. Then I went to my professor, Dr. Shrikant Ganvir, and I asked him that, sir, aap temple tumple mein deal karte ho. Aap batao ki main martial arts aur aisa kuch kar sakta hu. Can I do something? Initially, even he thought, हाँ वाली सुग्रीव वगैरह के स्कल्पचर होते हैं उसपे कुछ मास्टर्स डिसर्टेशन कर लो बट इफ आई एम इंटरेस्टेड इन समथिंग आई लाइक टू गो डीप डाउन एंड आई डोंट लीव इट आई एक्चुअली फिगर्ड आउट थ्रू दीज स्कल्पचर्स ऑफ ग्रैपलिंग आई कैन टेक्निकली नॉट जस्ट बी वेरी सिंपलिस्टिक दैट ओ टेम्पल हैड दीज स्कल्पचर्स टू एक्चुअली स्टार्ट understanding India as a whole. That's a complete conversation. I have written a lot of articles and I'm still working on it. Two best things have happened to me in my life. One is getting acquainted with children. Second was doing my PhD research.
Okay.
Because of my PhD research, I started going to an MMA gym. At that time, I was young. I was 25 odd years for my master's dissertation. So I thought, ab pehlwani pe kar rahe ho, tum thoda sa karke bhi dekh lo. And trust me, it's not that good when you're fighting with professional fighters. Delhi being the place it is as it is, known for its roadside brawls. These people come to these gyms to make sure they don't brawl outside. So you know inside the gym, they will go all out. My fight club where I learned whatever little bit of jujitsu, boxing, Muay Thai is like my family now. They also learned to accept me. They knew that I will not come every day, that I will not do everything that my coach tells me. My coach, Siddharth Singh, he knows me so well now. He doesn't judge me anymore. And my entire fight team doesn't judge me. So initially, you know, when I started training, all of them are professional fighters now. Our gym has just signed a fighter with the UFC, which is like the motherload of mixed martial arts. I mean, that's how successful my gym is. All of these youngsters, I have seen them, I have trained with them when they were teenagers. They are more mature than me to realize that, Kush, why don't you come and sit and watch us fight? I was always injured. But then they sort of realized that, okay, Kush wants to do jujitsu for research. I don't want to choke people for a living. Even right now, cross-trained fight club. And then when I was working in Bangalore, I joined another gym called Institute of Jiu-Jitsu. I actually found a lot more encouragement, motivation and following in the fight industry than in archaeology. Everyone in archaeology le joke around, oh, Gadadhari Bhim aa gaya, Pehlwan aa gaya, Malla aa gaya. Now that people have seen that I've done my PhD, I've given so many podcast interviews and stuff to different places. So now like people have started taking me a bit seriously. But I'm fine with
it. So you said Vali and Sugriv, who featured in your PhD dissertation. How did you go deeper into that?
When we see a temple, most of us look at a temple from a very religious, pious point of view. But the reality of the situation is that what we define as a Hindu temple today is not the way it was defined earlier. Temples were centers for power. Temples were landowners. Temples were employers. Temples were places of gathering. Temples were places of festivities. There were Kalyana Mandapam. There were Bhoga Mandapam. They were places for charity. Same way the mosques are today. There are orphanages running out of mosques, out of churches. All the religious bodies all over the world, under the umbrella of religion, they don't just pray all the time, right? They do a lot of other stuff. There is lack of awareness regarding these cultural processes. I have started an organization myself called Vratya Foundation, where I am writing graphic novels and comics on Indian culture to make our youth understand various cultural phenomenons. For me, a temple can be interpreted on multiple levels. And the sculptures on the temple. People always joke about Khajuraho temples, erotic sculptures. If you go deep into it, like I have a friend, Anuja, then I have a mentor, Devangna Desai ma'am, who went so deep into those sculptures that they were not just erotic sculptures. They had a lot of significant meaning for the people of that time. They actually symbolize a lot about the contemporary human behavior and mindset. We have to understand the Tantra Shastras. We have to understand the Shaiv Agamas, Vaishnav texts. Even Shaiv, Vaishnav, within Shaiva, there is Kalamukha, there is Kapalika, there is Nath Sampradaya. The sculptures that I dealt with were not just religious in nature. The sculptures had a lot of deeper symbolic meaning. For example, I did my PhD on sculptures of grappling and pugilism, which is basically boxing and grappling, on Vijayanagar monuments. For my PhD, I went around Northern Karnataka, I saw Badami Chalukyan monuments, I saw Yadav, Rashtrakoot, and I saw a lot of monuments. To figure out my PhD topic, I would have seen around 200 temples for identifying my area. Vijayanagar was a very unique setup. Again, universe has its ways. In Pune, I started doing another martial art because there was no jujitsu. Started doing capoeira. Now, capoeira has its own very symbolic meaning. It is something that is comparable to, say, Kalaripayattu in Kerala or Chow, martial dance of Mayurbhanj, Saraikela area. We went for a road trip from Pune to Hampi just to chill because Hampi is known for a lot of other reasons as well. Once you cross the river, my friends were enthusiastic in that point of view as well. Just hanging around with them, showing them over, like, I found out a lot of sculptures of my topic. Then I did repeated visits to Hampi. Then I decided, okay, let's see more temples in Karnataka. Then I deliberately took up a job in Bangalore in an IB school. So that I could bootstrap my PhD research. Every weekend, I was on the road. I used to take the Karnataka Sarige, or I used to go to Majestic from Bangalore, go all the way to Anantapur, Lepakshi, and roamed around. Okay. Not a single word of Telugu, not a single word of Kannada. I learned, word a temple, word a devasthanam illidira. I just had to say this much and people would point and I would walk there. The temples would feed me. I have actually, in my Rayalaseema fieldwork, so Rayachoti, Somapalam, all of these villages don't have places to stay. At Rayachoti, I did not find a bus to Kadiri where I had to see the next temple. So it was quite dark and the pujari allowed me to sleep in a Vijayanagar temple. It was a living shrine. The next morning I woke up, went to Kadiri, to Lakshmi Narasimha's temple. Archaeology taught me a lot of such things, a lot of life skills. I'm not an excavator. When people think archaeology, the first thing they are like, ek to hat hogi aur haath mein ek haath mein hunter. And next hand they will either have a pitchfork or a shovel or something. I am not that kind of an archaeologist. Martial arts made me learn a lot of things. I would actually see that there are certain moves that I'm really good at. And when I'm sparring with my coach or someone, I would actually stick to them. Here's when I think a lot of transference and liquid or fluid intelligence helped me. Applying my learnings from various other parallel experiences I've had to my other parts of life made me a lot more wiser and mature. A lot of my friends would say I have a long way to go in these departments. But I think my skills from jujitsu, I actually am not able to apply them in jujitsu because all of my opponents are stronger than me in the gym. I actually apply them in my career. Similarly, my anthropological and archaeological fieldwork and experience knowledge helps me to connect with the fighters. If someone is from Haryana, I can speak a little bit of Bangru. When I was doing my PhD fieldwork, I went to Kolhapur, I went to Mysuru. So these two places are like hubs of Malla Yuddha. I learned Marathi by just going around villages with my professors. I could not learn Kannada because I think Kannada was a lot tougher for a North Indian like me to adapt to. But I could understand very basic stuff and I could communicate. And the best part about wrestling was that in Mysuru, I met with a lot of jetties. I was not able to understand. They did the moves on me. And it was really fun. It was not like we were fighting. I would just talk, like, for example, what we see in jujitsu today is very similar to medieval periods, Jambuvanti Mallavidya, Hanumanti Mallavidya. And again, why people call it Hanumanti? Why people call it Jambuvanti? It's not just because these people were strong, but there are certain moves which required the intellect of these mythical characters. So it is very interesting how grappling helped me understand mythology. It helped me understand folk culture. Maharashtra and Karnataka were like the hubs. Then I got deeper into local religious deities. In Andhra, Tamil Nadu, we have Mailar. Mallari in Maharashtra, it's the same.
Okay.
And then there is Mallanna. Then there are these Khandoba. Connecting with the local people helped me get better at a lot of things in my fight world. All the fighters mostly don't come from very affluent backgrounds. To be a fighter, you need to be a killer. There needs to be a switch in you, which you, when you turn on, you don't think about anything else. My coach, Siddharth Singh, with him, I have just seen so many fighters. Like, seen Afghans, I have seen Iranian fighters, I have seen Northeastern people. I think they are born with a six-pack. You know, these Afghans, these Northeastern fighters, a lot of, say, from Maharashtra, from Kolhapur and Marathwada area, their whole background is into farming, hardcore physical work. You don't become a fighter by just watching videos. Or, you know, or by wearing expensive rash guards, speaking the dope language. Once the cage shuts, everyone will know who is a fighter. It's good that I realized that before the cage shut, so I was safe.
Yeah.
The type of people I connected with, I think I was so humbled. My PhD led me so deep into knowing so many good people who don't even get the type of attention that I am getting right now. Who have fought for the country in a boxing ring, or who have represented the country in Thailand in Muay Thai by bouts, but no one knows about them because they don't play cricket. A lot of humbling experiences through my PhD research. I lived my PhD research, unlike what a lot of archaeologists do or a lot of PhD scholars in general do. I've been very lucky that I have a very practical mindset in things. So I'm not very connected or invested emotionally into a lot of things. That can be bad also, that can be good also.
Yeah, that's true. Let's say you look at a sculpture, which is to do with wrestling. How do you draw interpretations? Because you might have texts which describe some of the sculptures which are there. But the cultural aspects of these images, how do you begin to go deeper into that?
What majorly archaeology deals with is iconography. Just to give a basic information, a sculpture is studied by an archaeologist as an archaeological source material. Anything more than 100 years old comes under the purview of archaeology. So an archaeologist will look at the sculpture as an artifact, while at the same time, someone from a fine arts background, arts and aesthetics background, will look at a sculpture from a more holistic visual culture or a popular culture point of view. So they will look at iconometry, they will look at the composition of the sculpture, the stone used, the type of chiseling marks done, the type of artwork. They will try to interpret which school of art it comes from. For them, it's a very aesthetic sense.
Right.
For an archaeologist, it's not more of an aesthetic object of appreciation. It's more of a heritage or an artifactual object of human behavior. And at the same time, a grappler will see, see, he's holding a necktie or he's holding a single leg. While I was successful in identifying the sculptures from a grappler's point of view and an archaeologist's point of view, what happened was my PhD evaluator was an arts and aesthetics person. So in 45 minutes, he gave me a boot camp on arts and aesthetics during my PhD evaluation. It wasn't a very pleasant feeling when I was getting that lecture from him. But now I look at it in hindsight, I'm very, very, very grateful to his hard words. You know, like I say, लातों के भूत बातों से नहीं मानते हैं. Now I realize how people should approach sculpture from a cultural angle. It needs to be a very multidisciplinary approach. You cannot be an archaeologist and not study a sculpture from aesthetics point of view or historical point of view. There are multiple phases of identifying a sculpture. The first is identify what is happening. If you can identify the people in the act of grappling, well and good, then you identify what they are wearing, what kind of physical appearance the sculpture has. The second phase comes if you can identify or place that sculpture in a context. For example, if it is Vali Sugriv, you know it is Kishkindha Kand of Ramayana. That's your
Okay.
greater pitch. But if you don't know, that's when the game gets tricky. In my case, the sculptures on temples which deal with grappling don't find much mention in the Shilpa Shastra. When we look at the Shilpa Shastra or Vastu Shastra texts for each period, right from Vishnu Dharmottar Puran, Matsya Puran, then we go to Mayamatam, Manasara, which are even late, and the latest being Shri Tattvanidhi of Krishna Raja Vodayar III. They are more dealing with sculptures which are religious in nature, so they compartmentalize them as Shaiva, Vaishnav, Shakta, minor gods and divinities, Surasundaris, floral motifs. Then you have to figure out, why are my sculptures not mentioned in the Shastra? It gets tougher. Then you need to understand that, okay, now I have to, then comes the third phase. That is when you don't take that sculpture in isolation, but sculpture as a part of a whole body, that is the temple. And that temple is more like an epicenter of the area. Then I will not look at one particular sculpture, but have to study the cultural scheme of the temple. Based on the sculptural scheme, based on the period of the temple, you will actually have to study local history of the area. Then slowly you have to expand. Now, it depends on your research methodology and your skill set on how broad you want to be versus how niche you want to be. The thing is, in a PhD, you have to state what exactly you intend to do. For me, what began as a phase one PhD thesis, when the evaluator evaluated my thesis, I thought that I had covered all the three phases. But he very nicely said, beta, tumne pehla phase hi kiya. And he still awarded me the PhD because this kind of work was never done before. So I think I was lucky that I was the first one to do it. Otherwise, God knows, I would have been rewriting my PhD thesis today.
Okay.
But what he actually pushed me to do, I am right now converting my PhD thesis into a monograph. Because apparently every PhD scholar should do that if they, in a rainy day, want a job in a university. Pray to God that I don't have to apply for a job again. Me being practical, you should always have contingencies. When I'm converting my PhD thesis into a monograph, I am actually taking each and every pointer that the evaluator told me into consideration. And I have just, I mean, it's mind-blowing.
It's fascinating because the arts are normally seen as dance and music, whereas this is always seen as something physical. So there is no application of the mind here. But from whatever you've told me so far, there is such a wealth of knowledge that needs to be uncovered.
Oh, that's
about
big misconception. You fight and then you will realize there is more mind than body. Sun Tzu has very nicely said, what happens on the battlefield is a byproduct of what happens in the head before that. The type of strategizing, the type of mental preparation it takes to condition a fighter. When the cage is locked, you have to be so good at what you have learned that it needs to happen unconsciously or subconsciously.
Right.
For that, the conditioning of brain is the ultimate factor. I think physically I'm very fit, but the only reason why I could not take up martial arts even at an amateur level, I mean, I still somewhere regret not being able to fight. And I tell my mother this enough, but main reason why I haven't become a good martial artist in my eyes is not physical. It's mental. I did not have the maturity and the sincerity to put in that much effort. Mentally, if I was strong enough during those days, I don't think anything would have been able to stop me, because I'm really smart when it comes to identifying various moves. I have a good memory, but all that is useless if you are mentally not stable.
This has been so instructive, Kush. It's a fascinating journey. Thank you for coming on the show. The fact that you go deep into something and you have a point of view that people may not agree with, but that doesn't in any way take away from what
you're doing. That is completely fine.
Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Venu.
My First Job, the podcast, is a production from Ideascape Communications. Guest relations, promotions, and creative is managed by Deepa Ravi with occasional support by Venugopal Nair. Archiving and technical help is provided by LPS Jayachandran.